Mouthing Off is a theater, arts, and culture podcast from Bad Mouth Theater Company in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Amanda Forstrom.
I'm Kevin Couchman.
And I'm Mari Sittner. Mouthing Off features compelling interviews and discussions with artists and creators from around the Twin Cities and beyond.
Tune in for something different online where you get your podcasts at badmouthtc.com and on the air in St. Paul through Frogtown Radio 94.1 FM.
And if you've got something going on around the Twin Cities you'd like to talk about, we want to hear from you. Email us at badmouthtc@gmail.com.
Mouthing Off is sponsored by Minnesota Playlist, the digital destination for live performing arts. Producers can find talent to work with, directors can cast productions with audition ads, teachers can find students with a classified, and audiences can find the perfect show to attend on the state's largest calendar of theater and dance shows. Find out more at minnesotaplaylist.com.
We hope you enjoy the show.
All right, we're back with another episode of Mouthing Off, the theater arts and culture podcast for the Twin Cities and beyond. And we're way beyond here today. We got New York, Mari Sittner. Mari, how are you?
I'm doing great. I mean, we got some gloomy spring weather. I saw a daffodil yesterday.
A whole daffodil. One. Yeah.
It was Where was it?
In Tryon Park up there in Washington.
Right on the street.
A street daffodil, no less.
Right on the street.
Incredible. And we have Amanda Forstrom here in the great state of Minnesota. Amanda, how are you?
I'm doing excellent. No daffodils yet, but I've seen some robins out, heard them singing. Very exciting. Spring is on the way, folks.
Absolutely. And I'm having my gutters cleaned. So if you hear a little ambient noise there, that's we're making radio here at Bad Mouth Theater Company, badmouthtc.com. We got a lot of good stuff coming your way today. This is principally an interview podcast. We interview people around the Twin Cities and beyond. I feel like our guest today is kind of part of the Twin Cities through me, because although she is across the water, she's across the pond, as they say. She and I work on all kinds of projects together as screenwriting partners, as writing partners. The great Abby Lucas is here. How are you, Abby?
I'm great. I also saw some street daffodils today here in London. Spring is definitely coming our way.
Love it. Abby, tell people about you, people who don't know you. You principally identify as a director of film.
Yes, I principally identify as a director of film. I'm from a small town called Pai here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I moved to the UK about 17 years ago, where I've worked in film across like advertising, TV, short film, web series, and I also directed some theater at a time as well. But yeah, primarily short film at the moment, and about to do my first feature next year.
Ah, the first feature. And I know you recently were in the United States. You were over here in California. Yes. working on a short film. People can find you and your work at abbylucas.com. It's A-B-B-I-E Lucas, like Lucas Oil.
Like George.
Like George.
Like George.
George.
There you go. No relation. Sadly.
alas. I think you'd be well past your first feature if you were the product of
I would
George
hope so.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, let's talk about, let's talk about the short that you just worked on out in California. And then I want to hear about this feature as much as you can tell us. And we'll talk about kind of your background and how you got into film, all of it. But let's hear about the short first.
Okay, so I just directed a short film called Reconsolidation out in Fresno, California. And I was first approached in 2016 by the couple of guys who wrote the film. They are Blake Ellis and Brandon Weiss. They're two writer actors and now turned producers because they produced the film as well. But in 2016, I'd made a film called Testing Greta, which we shot over here in London. And Blake, who I know through a playwright friend of the two of us, a guy called Ross Howard, who's a very talented playwright, we'd been chatting about some other projects in the past, and then he saw these images from Testing Greta, and he was like, wow, the style of this really fits what we're going for with this script that we've just written. Do you mind taking a look at it? So I took a look at the script. It's a very exciting script, a kind of a psychological thriller slash soft sci-fi about a man who is going through a lot of like loss and grief issues, and he is offered this like tech that's kind of in a beta mode by his therapist to reconsolidate the memories of a car accident that his best friend dies in. So when he goes to sleep at night, he takes some prescription medication, plugs in this like airpiece, and he is able to re-enter that memory like it's a dream and try to reprogram it. And no spoilers, of course. Some weird stuff happens, and there's a bit of a twist at the end. But yes, initially it was 2016. I was approached with this, and I think Blake and Brandon had some things that they wanted to work on with the script. They'd sent it to a few festivals. It got a few awards as a screenplay. It went through a few different stages. So the script that I'd originally been given, it was very different from what we filmed. Still the same concept and the same kind of like heart to it, but quite a different script. And obviously, you know, the pandemic happened, so we couldn't film during then. And it was a long time coming to get it into production, but I think it came at exactly the right time. Everyone was in a position where they felt really ready to take the script on and the production. We'd got this guy called Justin McLeese involved as the DOP. He has a really great company out in Fresno called Blair Media. And so he had all his guys on hand. They came and they were just the most incredible people to work with, like super hardworking, super ambitious, and everything that I needed or wanted just arrived. And it was an amazing sort of shooting experience. And yeah, now I just have to go into post-production on it, where I will be editing and working with my composers, 222 Music, who've worked on the last four films that I've done. So yeah, I'm really excited to see how it turns out.
Amazing. And the first feature, I know you've been looking for that for a long time. And as a director, yes, that's obviously a very big deal. Your debut. What can you tell us about that? What's going on there?
So in 2022, I directed a film called Voices, which similar to Reconsolidation is also a little bit of a like soft sci-fi thriller, but with a bit of dark comedy added into it. We recently released that film on the YouTube channel Omeletto, which is like it's supposed to be the home of the best short films. So it's up there. There's a lot of subscribers to the film. It's now available for people to check out. So that one's called Voices. It was written by a guy called Omar Khan, who also performs in it. He's an excellent writer, is like doing a lot of TV writing and stuff. And he had approached me and said, I've got an idea for another short. And I was like, great. I'm happy to work with you again. And then he was like, no, it's a feature. We're going to do a feature. I was like, okay, cool. So he is currently writing still. I mean, we're going to go ahead and do it because he's already managed to secure about 50% of the funding. But he's writing a micro budget thriller, and the sort of like one line pitch is that it's Steven Spielberg's Duel, but just a woman trying to make it home from the train station late at night. So,
okay.
The thriller journey of a woman who is being stalked by a man who is our truck in the scenario, I guess. And yeah, we think it'll be pretty easy to shoot in a short time period for like a small amount of money, you know, just cast a very charismatic actress who can hold the film for around 80 minutes or so. And yeah, it'll be a like super challenging, but quite exciting thing to do. And especially in this climate at the moment where it's like very hard to get a film off the ground, especially if it's your first one and you're trying to do like a budget of $1 million or like $3 million or whatever. We kind of just wanted to like take things into our own hands and make something that we could just get off the ground ourselves.
This is the way. And a film like that can be incredible. It can be as good or better than almost anything, than anything. The budget, the amount of money that's put on camera has nothing to do with the quality of a film at the end of the day. It does. I mean, you know, if you're going to make a big epic blockbuster, you can't make Dune for, for $500,000. But no, that sounds great. And like the film Locke with Tom Hardy, incredible. People love My Dinner with Andre. That's simple, but provocative. Sounds great. I remember I had Duel on and I waited for such a long time to watch it. I'm such a Jaws fan. Like Spielberg's not my favorite director. He's a great director. Not my favorite.
Spielberg has had an amazing career in the variety that he's been allowed to do, because a lot of the time as a film director, they want you to do that first film that puts you in a box, and then you continue to make that film again and again, essentially. But Spielberg's done, you know, history, sci-fi, action, romance. Like he's been allowed to sort of do the whole thing.
Well, I mean, I think Spielberg and his coterie, they took over the industry. So I think it's less about being allowed, and I think they became the bosses. they're still financing and everything. But I think after Jaws, it was, you know, they were the enfant terrible, and they took over, which is great and great for the history of American cinema, certainly. But Jaws, I mean, what an incredible film. So I waited to watch Duel, and then I finally put it on, and then, everybody here knows, you know, my lady walked into the room and, you know, in the middle of the movie, and she kind of looked at the screen. She's like, what's this? It's Duel. Oh, and then a minute passes. She sits on the couch kind of looking at it. She's like, what's going on? It's being chased. 5 minutes later, I'm really into this. I'm like, yeah, it's a Spielberg movie. And wasn't it made for TV, Duel?
It was made for TV. And then they liked it so much that they added an extra like 20 to 30 minutes to it so that it had the full feature length.
Incredible. Maybe
a guy being chased by a truck, like
absolutely.
Wild.
Yeah, totally incredible. And, you know, the other film that's like that is iconic is Mulholland Drive. Was originally a pilot for what was going to be kind of a new Twin Peaks type thing. Do you remember which network was it? Was it ABC? Because he had the relationship with ABC, or was it like HBO? Or I can't remember which one it was.
I don't remember.
But then he went to the French and got a bunch more money and turned it into this feature that's now like on a lot of people's top 50 all-time movie lists. It's crazy. That's genius. Feature. Yeah, the same guy who made the original, I say, a definitive Dune. We just did a watch party for that for my other podcast, Art of Darkness, artofdarkpod.com. We do watch parties for patrons. We did Lynch's Dune last night, and rewatching it after watching the Villeneuve version, I'm like, wow, it's incredible this even got made and released. It's so weird. Well, that's awesome, Abby. That's such a cool... trajectory you have. And of course, Badmouth, we just had a meeting before this podcast. We're going to do something. I don't know how much we want to tease it. We already did a reading of this script. It's something you and I wrote together, The Edge of Liberty. And it's a comedy about sued right-wing internet podcast grifters who try polyamory for the clicks. And it all goes horribly wrong. And it sounds like we're going to bring you to Minnesota. We're bringing Abby to Minnesota. For the first time, you've seen Fargo. You've seen A Prairie Home Companion. What are you most looking forward to about coming to Minnesota in late winter, Abby? The end of winter.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to see Prince's House. I think that would be cool.
Prince's House.
Yes. That's great.
Would you believe it? I've never been to Paisley Park. I know people who were hanging out in the 80s or the 90s and got picked up by Prince's people and who were like, they were like, you want to come and Prince is having a party. You want to come out? he would literally drive people out in like limos or, you know, cars. This is a true story. And the pancake story is true. He would just play music for people, party, supposed to be just a fun, he was a gentleman, you know, and then you'd get served pancakes. He wouldn't serve the pancakes. He wouldn't make the pancakes. People do it.
There's a pancake guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Prince had a pancake guy. And RIP gone too soon. Yeah. No. You know what? We'll go to Paisley Park. We'll take Abby to Paisley Park.
I haven't gone to Paisley Park either, Kevin. So I feel bad Minnesotans.
Yeah.
I have also never been. So we're gonna have to take a group trip.
Yes.
Group trip to Paisley Park for Badmouth Theater Company. It's going to be so fun. Hey, listen, by the way, if anybody has an inn over there, you're listening to this on 94.1 Frogtown Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota. You're listening to Mouthing Off. But no, really, if you have if you got an inn over at Paisley Park, like, please, we want to have you on the pod, and two, you know, hook us up. Like, let's get a tour. I want to see it. Yeah, we also got to go to Can Can Wonderland, Abby.
Yes. Yeah, we've got there is another film that we have written that is set in Minnesota. Yeah, so it would be good to preliminary scope some locations
after in the future. after your first feature premieres and you become you're the next Lucas, I think is what's going to happen.
Yes.
Absolutely. And it was internet. Lucas, yeah. It was International Women's Day yesterday. And this is, we're having International Women's Podcast right now today. And I'm doing my part. I'm pulling my weight. I'm trying to thousands of years of misogyny. I'm like, one podcast, we're going to fix it all. But no, really, there, what do you think about that, Abby? Women directors don't, I mean, it's such a male dominated, and I'm not one of these woke kind of da da da. I know Amanda has something to say, but go ahead, Amanda.
Just tailing onto that or adding onto that, Kevin, do we dare bring up Abby? Can you give us your opinion or opine on the scandal, as it were, of Greta Gerwig not being nominated for an Oscar for Barbie? What are your thoughts on that?
I have not given any thoughts on this. Like, I loved Barbie. I thought it was a lot of fun. I think it is, it had the most wonderful trailer for a film I've ever seen, because it is the only trailer that I've ever seen that I've gone, I want to watch this film and I have no idea what it is about. Like, they did a great job of like not giving anything away. I did the whole experience. We wore pink. I went with my girlfriend it was her birthday. She was pregnant. She was so excited to go. And we had a lot of fun. It was a fun film. I think they did a great job. I saw it a second time at this, we've got this organization in the UK called Directors UK. It's not quite a guild, but it's sort of a professional membership organization for directors. And they will do screenings coming up to the awards season where you'll have Q&As with the director. So Greta Gerwig was there. She was being interviewed by Alfonso Cuarón, which was incredible to have him there as well. And she talked a lot about how, like, Margot Robbie had approached her to do this film, to write the film, not even direct it at this point. And she was like, what am I, Barbie? Like, what story am I going to tell? And it got to the point where her and her partner, Noah Baumbach, had written the script. And she was like, listen, I don't need to make a Barbie film. I will only make this Barbie film. So if they reject it, like, that's fine. I'll walk away. Like, I don't need to have like this big Mattel franchise behind me or whatever. And so I really liked that was what she wanted to do. In saying that, so I think she did an amazing job directing it, creating that whole world, writing it. She did a fantastic job. I don't think it's an Oscar film. So I'm not surprised she didn't get nominated for Best Director. But in saying that, I'm not saying that like Oscar nominated films are like necessarily better than than the majority of films out there. I mean, I know BAFTA members. They are ordinary people working in the film industry. Do they have superior taste to everybody? No. And they're the people that like get the films that are going to be voted for and then vote on them. And then they win the awards. The Academy has got to be exactly the same. I mean, it's like, obviously it's sad for her, but I don't think it actually means that great a deal. She broke a lot of boundaries. She made a lot of money, and she, like, her and Christopher Nolan with Oppenheimer, like, I think revived cinema in like a summer. So
agreed. And I think that's what's most important, you know?
Yo, I mean, and now Villeneuve with Dune 2.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you seen it yet?
And none of those are Marvel films. So there we go.
Right. I was very concerned because I went on the record, and I now regret it, and I'm trying to make up for it on the other pod, kind of as a Dune 1 skeptic, because I didn't get it. I was sort of watching it on its own for its own merit, not mm-hmm. thinking like, oh, this is all set up for Dune 2. They're one movie, right? You're not going to sit down and watch Dune 1 and then not watch Dune 2 unless you're like, it's just not your thing. And now, having seen Dune 2, I was getting chills in the theater, and I'm 41 years old, and I was sitting there and like against my will getting chills and going, wait, what is it? Oh, these are feelings. I'm having feelings. That's what those are. I didn't see Oppenheimer in the cinema, and I regret it. I got to go. And
you definitely have to see it in the cinema. It's not a streaming movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you do the Barbenheimer experience, Abby?
I didn't do them on the same day. I did them a week apart from each other.
Okay. So you did the Irish Barbenheimer.
The Irish Barbenheimer.
Like Irish twins?
Yeah. The Irish.
That is the show title. I was gonna call this episode Honorary Minnesotan, but I think Irish Barbenheimer is better. But you are an honorary Minnesotan. I will see Barbie at some point. How much merch do you think they moved, like, for Mattel? Like,
oh,
do you think when she walks into the Mattel offices, what do you think? They just, everybody bows. She's like the Kwisatz Haderach. She's she's the Messiah of Mattel. I mean, how much of that last Christmas do you think they sold Barbies because of that movie?
It's
hundreds of millions of dollars.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I know for a fact they sold a lot of Barbie Halloween costumes, because on November 1st, Facebook Marketplace was all people selling their Margot Robbie Barbie Halloween costumes. So they definitely made a lot of money just selling pink stuff. They were collaborating everywhere. You couldn't go to the mall without every sign having something special for Barbie.
Yeah, and I'm sure the collector's items, just, you know, the old Barbies, the old outfits that you can't get, you know, that boxes that have never been opened. I'm sure they just skyrocketed in price.
And I'm curious, Abby, we talked a little bit about the Oscars and sort of what they mean, but since they are, I think, tomorrow, what are your opinions on the Oscars and award shows and all those things?
How many are you going to win? Is really
exactly.
I don't know how many I'm going to win. I mean, hopefully something, but like as an audience member, I find award shows a little boring. I prefer to just wake up the next day and see who's won what. You know, obviously it's very exciting for whoever is being nominated and then wins. But like, it's bizarre because so much of art is subjective, and how can you award something that, is going to affect all sorts of people differently? I think yeah, I think it's great to acknowledge people's work for things, but yeah, it's I don't know how I feel about awards.
It's so tricky too, because the world has become rather ugly and America has started to fall apart, and a lot of people have noticed it. And this isn't a political podcast, but I will say that particularly since the Iraq, Afghanistan, the recession, there's a detachment from reality that doesn't really make sense anymore. It's like kind of gauche. These millionaires in LA, in sunny LA, patting one another on the back. And they're always kind of looking for ways to be relevant. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the ratings for the Oscars, but it's bad, bad. Like, it's a collapse. It collapsed. Their ratings have collapsed harder than internet dog coins, than meme coins. Funny internet, magic internet beans collapsed. Maybe they'll come back like the magic internet beans did. But I mean, I'll look up some numbers in the background. It's not good. You know, so they've lost cultural relevance. And then, so then you have to imagine the Academy is sort of, they're going to do anything to kind of get that back. But one thing I'll shut up here, but one thing I notice is it just like, we want to go to that. We want to look at those folks as the magic people, you know, the beautiful people, the glamorous people. But like, if everybody out here in the hinterlands is feeling like everything's falling apart and losing hope and politics is becoming more crude and more divisive, it's really hard to tune in on a Sunday night and watch people. I mean, and you know, and the comedian and Rick and Gervais captured that. Yeah, Amanda. Yeah.
Yeah. And to add to that, I think it's because that accessibility or any pathway to having any morsel of that kind of wealth or prestige or whatever has never been further out of reach. And so it just becomes harder and harder to watch, because you'll know you'll never have that. You'll never be that. You'll never... and it's not just the glitz and glamour. It's just even, you know, being able to go out on a Saturday night or have, you know, the Ivies in Minneapolis, St. Paul were canceled. And so artists even here aren't getting together to celebrate their work. So Hollywood is real.
When we really take over, when we Spielberg this place, which we're trying to do, and by the way, everybody in the Twin Cities and beyond, but principally the Twin Cities, if you want to come on A Mouthing Off and talk with us for an hour, badmouthtc@gmail.com. When we do our awards, you know what we're going to call them? We're going to call them the baddies. The Badmouth Theater Company Awards will be the baddies. Abby, you had a thought.
Well, the baddies.
The baddies. I mean, also when you've taken a little bit of a peek behind the curtain, a lot of the movies that get nominated for these sorts of things, their marketing budget is at least half the budget of the film again. And so they get nominated because they have enough money to be able to be marketed to the general public, but also even just to the voting people. So like, for instance, the short films that win Oscars, a lot of them have like PR companies behind them, which, you know, constantly puts them out on social media, like in front of other producers, in front of voting bodies, those sorts of things. So it's like, it's not as if it's a process where like, there's all the films out there and they're the cream that have risen to the crop. We're looking at a selection of movies that have being fiercely advertised to us and also had the money behind them to be able to be screened theatrically in theaters to be able to qualify to even get to that upper echelon realm to even be, you know, nominated for an Oscar. There's like a lot of like pre-selections and stuff that goes on before you even get to that point.
Right. Yeah, politics. I mean, it's true anywhere. I mean, and at the risk of doubling down on the political aspect of this, the divorce between, let's say, L.A., Southern California, the politics of the people involved and the everyday American out on the street, I don't think has probably ever been greater. And nobody wants to be lectured at by rich people. So it's tricky. And we've returned after a brief interregnum, we've returned to the era of real politics. The era where maybe both the parties agreed on undergirding principles and there was a coherent centrism is gone. And so I think that affects something even like the Oscars. I'm very curious to see what the effect of Dune being this Dune, Barbie, Oppenheimer, like, and again, I haven't seen Barbie. I'm not the target demo for Barbie.
No.
you know, although, listen, I'm going into my Ken summer. I'm going, this is my Ken summer. I'm, it's real. It's happening. But like Oppenheimer, which I will go see in the cinema. I regret not seeing it in the cinema. I should have. I'm going to start going to see more movies. There's a place over here where Tuesdays I can go for $6. Like, what excuse do I have? Yeah. And they got nice reclining chairs or whatever. But like watching Dune 2, I was like, oh, it's not so bad. We're going to be okay. We can still make this. Whoa. Like, it was such a white pill. Yeah. Yeah. Mari.
I will say that this past year, more so than other years. I mean, I remember back when I was in high school and it was all Moonlight and Lady Bird, which are both great movies, but every year there was a, you know, big moral idea movie that would be the center and it would win. But this year it did feel like even some of the smaller movies, quote, smaller movies, that were still huge studio releases were really for everyone, because I had the opportunity to see two movies this year that I loved, which were Poor Things and The Holdovers. And those are, you know, they're big studio movies, but they're a little smaller. They're a little artsier, but they were really for everyone. There wasn't anything in them that was too alienating, that nothing that somebody, you know, in the flyover country wouldn't enjoy as much as somebody in New York or LA. And that's made me feel pretty optimistic about seeing more movies in the theaters and the type of things that are going to get made going forward.
Poor Things is deranged. I loved it. It was fun.
Amazing.
I haven't seen it yet.
No spoilers. I haven't seen it yet either. I'm going to have to see it in the next couple of weeks because I have to go on another podcast and talk about the script. I've been sent the script, so I have to read the script and talk about that. But 2023 was a fantastic year for films. I went to London Film Festival to see a few of them, and The Holdovers was one of them. And that was, I mean, that kind of felt like a return to like the type of films that we made in the 90s, where it was like, oh, it doesn't have to have this like giant IP behind it, which I think there's a lot of there's a lot of fear in the industry at the moment. There's not a lot of risks being taken. It's probably a lot to do with people like now wanting to stay home with their streamers rather than going out to the cinema. So all our cinema releases are these huge blockbuster comic book films because they know that they'll get the bums on seats for those. But like, yeah, the Holdovers like felt like the kind of thing we might have watched in the 90s when there was a lot more indie films, even though it isn't like typically an indie film. But your Poor Things I haven't seen yet. Zone of Interest, like a very harrowing film, but brilliant film. Yeah, there were a lot of like really great films that came out last year that I feel haven't been coming out in the previous years. And obviously we had COVID, so there wasn't a huge amount of production happening. But I'm hoping that there will be more of this coming into 2024 as well, and that people will want to go to the cinema to see them.
I'm reading, and by the way, just the fact that nobody's watching the Oscars or taking in the Oscars in the traditional way doesn't mean that the Oscars are, how to say this, doesn't mean that cinema is losing relevance. I don't think that's the case. I mean, these are our dreams. Like you watch Dune, I had such an acute sense of like, oh my God, this is our collective secular mythology. I mean, this is it. This is our shared mythology. Like, you're not going to go into a public space and start ranting about Catholicism. Like, I might, but you know, the average person is going to do it. But we can talk about Dune and then get at some of these ideas. You know, I mean, Dune is this movie about space witches, knife fighting, intergenerational psyops, 1,000-year eugenics programs. I mean, it's heavy material, you know, but also like wicked cool and funny and politically loaded anyway. And a dream. I went to a matinee. I'm probably going to go to another matinee. I've seen it twice. I'm going to go again.
I went tomorrow. To a matinee.
Ah, hooray. And I'm not giving anything away. But when you walk out, it's like you feel like you've just woken up from something. I love when cinema does that. But I've got an article from, this is credible, it's from Statista, and it's Oscars TV audience plummets to all-time low. So it peaked at recently, it was at 41.6 million people. And this is the TV viewership in 2010. And in 21, it was down under 10 million. So down to a quarter, that's not a lot of people. No. And we have 400 million people in this country. It's not a lot. That's almost marginal. Yikes. So, I think it's the tone, it's the style, and it feels out of touch. And it feels like, I don't know, hopefully they can get it back. Cause I liked watching the Oscars when I was a kid. Yeah. Yeah. Mari.
And it's also just the types of movies, like I mentioned before, that have, been winning the Oscars since, I don't know, the mid 90s, they were sort of the prestige films that were okay. Nobody saw them. No, no real people saw them. But, and I think people are really over being told by this out of touch Academy what is the best movie of the year. And that's at the end of the day why it doesn't really matter if Barbie isn't nominated for Best Director, because in a lot of people's hearts and minds, she was the best director of the year, and I'm sure her paycheck reflects that.
it's also like
Roger
she was
Robbie
a best
Hollywood now, so
true.
Yeah, she was a best director. That's the other thing. We all kind of know by now. Villeneuve. If he doesn't get it next year for this, it's okay. I mean, obviously they want it. I mean, and it impacts your money too. I know the Emmys, it literally impacts your pay scale. If you're a showrunner or a writer for a show and you get an Emmy nomination, your money goes up. Now you can afford a house in Santa Monica. Yeah.
I would say that all of those directors that have been nominated for Oscars though, I think their money was fine.
Yeah, no, fair enough. But I'm just saying it's not this stuff it doesn't matter, but and I'm talking about the Emmys now, but I know for sure the Emmys really impacts people's, budget. Yeah. And it's not cheap to live in LA. Yeah. Mari.
And so many people in the smaller categories, it's the editors and set designers and costume designers and lighting technicians, the Oscars and the Emmys and all of these awards, they're really for them too.
I think that's where it's really impactful. Yeah. Yeah. That's if you are a VFX company and you can put some Oscars and BAFTAs on your shelves, then you're going to get the better jobs coming into the next round of things that you work on. And that's where I think it does affect some change for people in the industry. But I also think just speaking of the Emmys, finding out what TV shows have won that year is more interesting to me than the films, I think, because it's there are so many TV shows and so many of them are so good, and it's not always immediately obvious which one's going to win.
Right. And what show got snubbed from the Emmys? It was Better Call Saul. Never got an Emmy nomination or did it never get a nomination or did it never win? And in any case, I think it never won. And then it ended and people were freaking out. The other one that's crazy, the Emmy snub, is It's Always Sunny. the most one of the most beloved.
Are we surprised?
Longest. Yeah, but it's ridiculous that they haven't, but dude, that's a group too that wow, talk about taking over, talking about making it on your own terms and just so consistently funny. I love it. I love that. I'm just going to nerd out on that. I love that Dennis has a secret family in North Dakota. Perfect. Yes. It's perfect. It's the best. Well, let's ask some of the questions. Abby, what's your approach to a project when somebody hands you a script or you write a script? But maybe we'll just say, hands you a script, what's your approach? I mean, how do you look for something that you want to do? And then what's the first thing you do after you put it down?
If I get given a script, it's purely an instinctual, decision whether I want to make it or not. If I find myself trying to intellectualize whether I say yes or no to it too much, it's probably a no. But if I read it and I can sort of see it in my head as I'm reading it, and it excites me, then it's a yes, or I'll at least throw my hat into the ring. And then after that, I will usually have a think about the type of imagery that I see it having, how I visually would represent the story, and then you sort of go to references like other films, art, photography, things in your environment, put together a collage or a lookbook of that type of stuff. And then really the most important part is getting together your entire team. So not just the cast, but also the creatives behind it, because directing is not doing everything yourself. It is surrounding yourself with the most talented people so that you can take credit for all of their great ideas. I don't know, just make your job as easy as possible. What they say about casting is always, it's 90% casting and then 10% just kind of tapping them into place and letting them bring it to life for you. Just finding the right team that understand the vision and then are also able to contribute to that with their own ideas, and really just put you in a position where you can say yes and no to things. And then depending on the budget of the production, you usually have somebody else who is taking care of all the details of getting it actually up and running. Just then make a whole lot of decisions. And then when you get onto set, hopefully you've done enough work in pre-production that it just sort of flows. But at that point, I find that you do as much preparation as you can beforehand in terms of what shots you want, what you think the blocking is going to be, all of that sort of stuff, and then be prepared to just completely throw it out the window if there's either a problem that needs to be solved or somebody comes up with something better on the day that changes the technicalities of it a little bit, and just be prepared and confident but ready to pivot or to be flexible at whatever stage. Yes.
Speaking of the Oscars, wasn't it the Oscars where they were taking away, or they thought they were taking away, the presentation of the editing award?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I was going to have you speak on, which is crazy, right? Any filmmaker would tell you that's insanity, because you also do editing.
Yes.
And I guess, how do you know when you're finished with a product, or how do you kind of even start carving out? I imagine it's something like you just have all of this footage. How do you even start, with this block of marble and then carving out what you see or what you want the product to be in all of the footage you got? Because I imagine there are, the story could be told in, a thousand different ways from all of the shots that you end up getting. So how do you focus on what you want out of it, or how do you get what you want out of it?
Well, because I am an editor, so I edit commercials and corporate films and branded content as my day job. Because I am an editor, a lot of the shots I plan, I've already kind of pre-edited in my head. So I will do things for safety that will give me more options. But a lot of the time I can already predict how it's going to be edited, just, in my own mind. So when I get to the edit, there isn't a lot of, it isn't a very like high ratio. I generally use everything that I've got, except that there will be better takes than other ones. But the process of that, it's a very interesting one, because in a perfect world, you have all of these options and you just get to like paint with all of these wonderful paints that you have, and it's perfect and you make some decisions. That doesn't always happen. A lot of the time it's problem solving. So you will end up with this one beautiful take where an actor does like an amazing performance on their close-up, but it has to match with this other actor's close-up where there will be something in the continuity that means that you can't have this one say this thing on that line and then go to them, and you have to kind of like solve the problem of how you will cover that in the best way possible and make it not look jarring. And continue the story. So it's a lot of actually working around things that have gone wrong. But it's in terms of when it's finished, a lot of that actually is just like you've hit your deadline and you're done now. Like I guess it would be the same with like doing a sculpture or a painting or something like that. Like there, you could come back and look at that like 5 years later and go, I'm not done. Like there are still things that I would do to it. But mm-hmm. I think once the story is all there, it's not confusing to anybody. You're happy with the performances. You've got a good rhythm. It feels good. It's got a pace. It's got a musicality to it. It's hitting all the right emotional beats. There's just a time where you have to just kind of step away and go, okay, like I need to get on with my life now or do something else or give it to the next person who has to work on it. I'm sure there are things that I've made in the past that I could like put back into Premiere today and make improvements to. But yeah, you have to finish it at some point.
And bouncing off of that, when you're with your own work that you write and direct, do you edit your own films? Do you work with a co-editor?
I do, but that is more budgetary reasons than anything else. I would much prefer to work with an editor on my own things, because I really think that having a fresh pair of eyes, like it improves it, because they, if they're good, obviously they'll see things in it that you don't see or you're a little bit blind to. I mean, there are a lot of times where directors aren't very good at editing their own things because they're emotionally attached to what they've shot. I'm not really like that because I edit most of the time, so I'm quite good at compartmentalizing and becoming quite brutal. But like, I have the potential to get overly brutal with my own things and sort of like cut it too much, maybe. I don't know. But I prefer to work with an editor than editing it myself. It's like it's too many hats. I don't like to work like that.
Have you ever gotten footage that surprised you when you were editing it? That, I didn't think it was going to go that way, or that you ended up including or not, or excluding, that kind of surprised you in the process that you hadn't had a forethought about the way that you thought it was going to be?
I think like the last time that might have happened was there was something I was editing that I'd shot. It was just like a little 5 minute short. And like in the edit, I was like, oh, we really need a wide shot here and we don't have one. And it was sort of this like, oh God, what am I going to do? Because I need to come wide on this. Like we're too close and we need to pull back a bit. And so it wasn't necessarily like a surprising thing, but a lot of it was shot on a gimbal. So there was just a point where the cinematographer had taken the camera back to rest for a bit so that he wasn't holding it. And the two actors were just kind of like tired at that point. And so they were kind of like not looking at each other, kind of just looking at the ground, but not talking. And they weren't acting at that point, but it was a pause that kind of fit the what I needed at that point. So I just edited that in as like a wide shot, but it was something that was never supposed to make the edit. It wasn't even being filmed. It was just that I was very lucky that there was enough of it that I was able to like cut it in as a shot and use it. And it really helped save that moment.
That's wonderful. That's amazing.
They didn't remove the editor from the Oscars, did they? That would be
they didn't insane. No, they just from the broadcast. So
oh,
they thought
from the podcast.
The general okay. public don't need to know who won best.
That's
editor.
Absurd because it is just such a key aspect of cinema.
And what is also wild about that is like I don't think it's the same in America, but in Britain, we have a problem at the moment where there's a larger problem where we're essentially a service industry to the States. Currently, we're not making a lot of our own films. It's a lot of people are shooting at the studios here and then doing their post-production and things. But the issue that we have is because kids in high school don't know what positions there are in the film industry. And if you're working on a huge budget film, there's hundreds upon hundreds of jobs on a film set. And so if they don't know about some of these things like editor, they maybe want to work in film, they go in thinking like, oh, I could be a producer or a writer or a director, an actor, like maybe a cinematographer. They might know about that, but they don't realize that they could potentially make six figures being like a first assistant camera person, a grip, like any of these other jobs that are always needed on these film sets, and they're paid well and you can make entire careers out of them. And like editing is a huge one. You can, people aren't like me. They don't go into editing wanting to be a director. There are people who just want to be an editor. And if people don't know about that, they don't know that these are career paths you can go into. The Oscars is an obvious one to like let people know that that exists. And it's so important to the storytelling because the script is written three times in the script writing, in the production, and in the editing. Again, you can your scripts could be like completely different from how the final film ends up being. And that's the editor who gets it there. They have a lot of creative control. They're not just pushing buttons because the director tells them to. They're the ones who are crafting that storyline.
Absolutely.
Amanda. Yeah.
No, I was going to say that, yeah, I wish they would bring that back. That's pretty sad.
They cut it from the Oscars, huh? That's crazy.
They said that they were going to cut it from the broadcast. I don't know if they then went through it because there was through with it because there was
so
a lot
much
of public
pushback.
Backlash. But mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Do the BAFTAs have include that as well?
I believe they do. Yeah, I think the categories for the BAFTAs is maybe less, so there's like less things to get through in the runtime. But yeah, they definitely is a BAFTA for best editing.
Well, we do not edit Mouthing Off, the theater arts and culture podcast from Bad Mouth Theater Company here in beautiful St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Kevin Kautzman with Mari Sittner in New York City, Amanda Forstrom here in the beautiful state of Minnesota, and honorary Minnesotan who we will be taking to Prince's house when she comes to visit to work on our project, The Edge of Liberty, which it's going to take a while. This time next year is probably when we're going to shoot this thing. So just be patient. And we'll try to get it done. We also got some other fun stuff coming up. We're probably going to produce my play, Moderation, probably at the Hive. So stay tuned. That's going to be a lot of fun. And go check out Abby's work online, abbylucas.com, abbielucas.com. You have all your links and everything there, right, Abby? It's all current?
It's all there. Yeah.
Awesome. Mouthing Off, Bad Mouth Theater Company, 94.1 Frogtown Radio. We got frogs everywhere here and online and Minnesota Playlist. Thank you, Playlist. Abby, will you come on again to Mouthing Off? Did you have a good time? I hope you did.
I had a wonderful time. Anytime.
Awesome. And we definitely, we learned what an Irish Barbenheimer is.